These days, when you watch Milwaukee Bucks, feels like every game, you're watching history. Because the team's superstar, Giannis Antetokounmpo, is a once-in-a-generation type of talent that the world has really never seen before.
And he hits it at the horn! A game winner for the Greek Freak!
He's done it all in Milwaukee.
Antetokounmpo drives! Oh!
Finals MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo!
He holds almost every franchise record. He's been the MVP of the NBA twice, Defensive Player of the Year, and in 2021, he brought home Milwaukee's first NBA championship in 50 years.
The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended. After a half century, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
That's why this past summer was so special. Because at Eurobasket, representing his country while playing for the Greek national team, he led the team to a bronze medal. Greece's first medal in 16 years. Coming back to Milwaukee, he explained what the experience meant to him.
I don't think people understand, like, what it is, how you feel when you represent your country. I don't think people, if everybody had the opportunity to represent the country in something, they will understand the euphoria.
And when he was asked what he would do if he had to choose between playing for the national team and playing for the NBA, he was surprised. And he had to think about it.
If I had to choose one between the NBA and play for the national team?
Because why would he have to make that choice?
Yeah, it's a difficult choice. I'm not going to lie. Representing the national team is the best honor that you can ask for and it's the best feeling. But at the end of the day, we don't get paid.
And walking away, he conceded that if there was a world where he could still make a great living, he would choose to play for the national team.
If the compensation was the same, I'd play for the national team all day long.
It seems impossible now, when the league is dominated by foreign-born unicorns. But in the not-too-distant past, the great European players of the era did have to make that choice. You could either represent your country or play in the NBA, but not both. Then something happened, something here in Milwaukee, that changed the course of history.
Anytime you put USA against USSR, you know the game has tremendous meaning.
Opening the doors so the greatest players in the world no longer had to choose one or the other. Before there was Dirk, Jokic, and Giannis, there was Gallus, Menegin, and Schmidt. Players that never had the chance to show NBA fans just how great they were because they chose their national team and a professional career in Europe over the NBA. So how did everything change? Well, this four-episode series will explain exactly that, featuring interviews with over 30 people from all over the world, including over a dozen Hall of Famers. Find out how the Bucks were chosen to represent the country and the NBA in the first-of-its-kind tournament that would transform the world of basketball. A story that begins with one man's struggle to bring this vision to life. In a world divided by a Cold War,
there wasn't a lot of dialogue, and there was some bad blood.
A tournament brought together basketball's superpowers.
At stake, basketball supremacy in the United States.
And showed that greatness knows no border.
It's a landmark game and a lot of media attention.
Featuring a EuroLeague juggernaut, the greatest national team in the world, and your Milwaukee Bucks.
Pressey on the drive, leaves it for Cumming.
Three teams put it all on the line and changed basketball forever. This is the untold story of a moment that would open the doors to a new world where the best players could finally play on basketball's biggest stages.
Oh, a little dancing time, showtime.
This is the oral history of the 1987 McDonald's Open. I'm Charlie Behrens, and you're listening to Bucks vs. the World, Season 6 of the Behind the Bucks podcast presented by Gallagher on the Bucks Plus Audio Network.
And I hope that people always remember that international basketball involving the NBA started right here in Milwaukee at the Backpack.
This is Chapter 1, For the Good of the Game. If you're going to change the world, it helps to have an interesting backstory. So it's fitting that for many years, Boris Stankovich lived something like a double life. During the day, he was a meat inspector in post-war Belgrade. But at night, well, at night, he dreamed of basketball.
Boris Stankovic is the most overlooked person in the history of basketball.
This is longtime Sports Illustrated writer Jack McCallum. Jack wants to make sure Boris gets his due. That's why he dedicated the first chapter of his best-selling book, Dream Team, to Boris. In it, Jack describes how before Boris made history, history made him. Coming of age in the Balkans during the Second World War, McCallum writes that at 19 years old, Boris was arrested alongside his father by an invading Russian army. Boris was released, but his father, a Serbian nationalist, was executed by firing squad. Even after this tragedy, Boris didn't let the brutality of the era diminish his belief in the unifying power of sport.
Boris was a Yugoslav, and Boris was a basketball guy, and basketball was very much in the heart and the soul of Yugoslavians. And Boris, that's the game that overtook him.
McCallum's contemporary, Bob Ryan, the legendary sports writer for the Boston Globe, saw the extraordinary impact Boris had on the game.
He was a basketball player himself, and he wanted to raise the bar for the world.
And how did he raise that bar? According to Bob, it was through sheer will.
But trust me, and there's no issue here, no argument. Boris Stankovic is the reason why Jokic exists to the level he does here today, and Doncic and all the rest of them. He set all these forces in motion completely because of Boris Stankovic's insistence that such a thing would happen, and he made it happen.
In the 1950s, after long days working as a meat and cheese inspector, Boris would moonlight as a professional basketball player. A large, skilled, and ground-bound forward, he made a few dozen appearances for Yugoslavia's national team and then became a successful coach in Belgrade. And in 1966, he said arrivederci to his day job, hung up his apron, put away his meat inspector stamp, and went to coach in Italy full-time. Within 2 years, he won the Italian League and was recruited to join FIBA, the world's foremost basketball governing body. And in 1976, he became its leader, FIBA's Secretary General. As Italian journalist Dario Colombo tells it, it was Boris's Yugoslavian roots that made him so capable of leading an organization with 161 member states.
Don't forget it. He was born in the former Yugoslavia. He came from a nation with different languages. He was really a man coming from, different worlds. And this, to me, helped him to understand all the other worlds around him. When he became Secretary General of FIBA, and for this, he was accepted.
And Dario's right. Yugoslavia was a country full of different worlds. Eventually, it would split into seven different countries. And growing up there definitely helped Boris relate to all the different worlds of the FIBA member nations. But no matter how popular of a leader he was, one of his ideas was out of this world. Leading FIBA, Boris wanted to revolutionize the game of basketball. But his vision was so radical, so ahead of its time, every time he brought it up, it would get rejected. It was like the universe was giving him the old Dikembe Mutombo finger wag. Here's Sports Illustrated's Jack McCallum on his crazy idea.
Boris became convinced that the only way this game was going to grow was if the best players played it.
What? That was it? That's all Boris wanted? Yes. The man simply wanted the world's best players playing on basketball's biggest stages, in the Olympics and in the NBA. Because get this, at the time, they couldn't. NBA players weren't allowed to play in the Olympics or the World Cup. As Dario Colombo recalls,
It was after Boris watched a U.S. team of college stars struggle at the 1982 World Championships in Colombia that he realized something needed to change.
On the flight back to Europe, Mr. Stankovic told me, no more selection like this on the international competition. I want to have the NBA players.
But in a world frozen over by the hysteria of the Cold War, divided by warring ideologies, militarized borders, and a freaking Iron Curtain, he was the only person crazy enough to think it could happen.
Boris Stankovic's viewpoint, and his was very solid, that at that point in time, the only people on the face of the earth that couldn't play in the World Championship or the Olympics were the guys that signed an NBA contract. Anyone else could play.
This is Terry Lyons. Back in the 1980s, when Boris started planning his revolution, Terry was just beginning his career at the NBA.
Boris pointed out that Drazen Petrovic, prior to signing with Portland, played for Real Madrid and pulled in some 800 or 900 grand a year. But then, of course, he was allowed to go back and play for the then Yugoslavian national team. But if you had an NBA contract, you weren't allowed to play. And Boris thought that that was just wrong.
Obviously, with the U.S. forced to play in college players against the rest of the world's best, brightest, and most burly grown men, it gave other countries a better chance to compete for gold. But the real problem with FIBA's ban on NBA players was that for the greatest international players of the time, they had to make an impossible choice. They could take their talents and play in the best league in the world, the NBA, or they could represent their country in the Olympics. But they couldn't do both. Yes, it's hard to believe, but before Boris Stankovic got his way, the NBA was home to the world's best basketball teams, but not all of the world's best basketball players.
A good example of that is Oscar Schmidt of Brazil, who was drafted and came very close to signing with the New Jersey Nets, but he knew if he wrote his name, he could never play for Brazil.
Now, you might be wondering, Oscar Schmidt? Who cares if he didn't play in the NBA? I've never heard of him. But that's exactly the point. He was a living legend.
At one time, the USA had a 20-point lead, but Brazil cut it to four moments ago before Willie Anderson stretched it to six. A 13-4 run by Brazil has tightened this game up, led by the great Oscar Schmidt.
The man dropped 46 points on the U.S. and helped Brazil steal the gold medal in the 1987 Pan American Games. The next year, in 1988, he averaged a 40-piece at the Olympics.
86-83, breaking the tie. That's 4 3-point shots by Oscar.
I don't know anybody I've ever seen that loves to score more than he does.
It's a shame because I think the NBA missed out on possibly one of the great, if not the greatest international player in Oscar Schmidt. Hall of Famer, you know. But if I were to circle one thing that was the single most important thing about bringing the world of basketball a little bit closer together, it would be the relationship formed with Boris Stankovic, and mainly by Russ Granick, certainly at the top of the list, and obviously David Stern, you know, right side by side with him. But Russ really was sort of in charge of that area of the business then.
For Russ Granick, who at the time was the NBA's executive vice president, and Commissioner David Stern's most trusted lieutenant, Boris Stankovic's reputation preceded him.
In the world of basketball outside the NBA, he was kind of this mythic figure, and he was a very large person as well.
And as NBA Commissioner David Stern pushed the league to expand its business globally, building a great relationship with Boris and FIBA felt like a slam dunk. The only problem was, even years after Stankovic's flight home from the World Championships in Colombia, FIBA and the NBA had never made contact with each other.
At that point, the NBA was like about 40 years old. There had never been the slightest contact between the NBA and international basketball.
So Boris finally decided to change that. But naturally, like a shy schoolboy looking for a prom date, he needed a wingman. So he had a mutual friend, Michael Goldberg, help him break the ice.
Yes, it very much came out of one conversation, basically, where in my office in New York, when one day Michael called me and said, Boris Stankovic is going to be in New York and he'd like to come up and meet with David and you. So we said, fine, sure, we'd love to meet with Dr. Stankovic.
And in 1985, David Stern and Russ Granick hosted a fateful meeting with Boris at their offices in Manhattan, and they were immediately struck by his determination to change the dynamics of international basketball.
And he came in with Michael and with Leon Wandel, and we started talking about the future. And he had an issue, I think, particularly to deal with, in that I think a lot of his constituents, the federations in various other countries, didn't necessarily look at the NBA as an ally. And it was clear that, in Dr. Stankovic's mind, we were closing in on a time when the NBA couldn't be the outcast anymore.
To Boris, the fact the NBA was the only league in the world whose players were banned from international competition was not just a moral issue. It was holding the rest of the world back. How could international players get better? How could they be their best if they weren't playing against and with the best? Sitting across from Stern and Granick for the first time, he saw his chance at fixing it.
Boris Stankovic was terrific at seeing the future, I think. He made it clear this was a goal of his. He wanted to get this done. And really the question became, well, how should we start?
Leaving the NBA's offices that day in 1985, Boris left with more than just a general idea of how FIBA could collaborate with the NBA. After meeting Granick and Stern, he was motivated to finally end the hypocrisy of FIBA's sham amateurism. Boris decided that, for the first time, he would take it to FIBA for a vote. This was his chance to force open the doors of global basketball and unite the NBA with the international game. So in 1986, the world finally had to reckon with Boris Stankovic's dream. And they rejected it. The FIBA member states voted down Boris's effort. Tradition prevailed. But according to Italian journalist Dario Colombo, Boris refused to be defeated.
He knew his fellows. He knew them. He knew that the first attempt would be not easy for him. But as I told you before, he was patient. He was quiet. He was like all the great men. He was not working to have immediately the result.
After the failed FIBA vote, Boris realized his collaboration with the NBA, that could be the showcase for his vision of the future of basketball. So in 1987, Boris and the NBA got to work on putting together a three-team tournament. And if he wanted to do something that would change the minds of FIBA's member states, he needed a main event, an international spectacle that would capture the world's attention. And for Boris and the NBA, the answer was obvious. This couldn't just be a battle of basketball heavyweights. It had to be a battle of superpowers.
The Soviet Union was an absolute must.
Russ Granick.
I don't think we would even have done it if the Soviet Union wasn't prepared to play us.
For Brian McIntyre, who ran the league's PR team at the time, playing the Soviet national team was a no-brainer.
If you're going to have a competition, why not have it with your archenemy? And add to the fact that the Soviet national team was a very, very good basketball team.
The Soviet national team versus an NBA team? In 1987, that would have higher stakes than just any old basketball game.
You know, you got to keep things in context. In 1987, the Cold War was still on. So it was the Soviet Union and the United States. There wasn't a lot of dialogue. And there was some bad blood. And I really think sports, as David Stern used to point out all the time, is something that can bring all of us together. It's a common denominator for the world.
World peace. I mean, that was a consideration. But for the NBA, who just began pursuing the growth of their business internationally, working with Stankovic helped them realize they could grow more than the bottom line. Opening the doors to international basketball could help them grow their talent pool, too.
The idea was to help make the game bigger. Let's do something that's different. It's never been done before. Let's do something big. But it was constantly, how do we grow the game? How do we grow the NBA? And this was one way to do both at the same time.
And with so much at stake, everything from international relations to the future of basketball, the tournament needed more than a home. It needed an NBA team to take on the Soviets. That meant representing not just the league, it meant representing the country and winning. No pressure or anything. So naturally, with the world on the line, they thought, how about Milwaukee? How about the Bucks? And if you're wondering, why Milwaukee? Well, it turns out that's a good question. Let's start with Brian McIntyre. He was there when it happened. Maybe he can tell us.
How we settled on Milwaukee, I honestly don't recall.
All right, sure. Well, what about Rick Welts? He was the NBA's VP of Communications at the time and was one of the execs responsible for putting on the whole tournament. Now he would know.
I honestly don't remember why Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that great international, metroplex.
Of course, yeah, that makes sense. Brian and Rick, they got called in after the Inquest Drive. Okay, but it was Russ Granick who put the deal together. If anyone knows why they picked Milwaukee, it has to be Russ.
You know, I don't remember exactly how he settled on Milwaukee.
Oh, okay, I give up. In fairness, it has been 38 years. And like the Friday night at Oktoberfest, the details have gotten a little bit blurry. But one thing is definitely clear. They picked the Bucks to play in this tournament because the Bucks were a great team. They had made the Eastern Conference Finals 3 times in the previous 5 years and were coming off 7 straight 50-win seasons. They were great, which is what the NBA needed. But not too great that it would scare FIBA off. Russ Granick explains.
The goal was to come up with a good representative team that had a track record of some success in the NBA, so you weren't taking the absolute bottom of the league, but you weren't rolling out the Lakers or the Celtics to try and embarrass anybody. And so somehow we settled on Milwaukee because they certainly had been a good, respectable NBA team. They jumped at the chance. They loved the idea. So we said, great, and we floated the notion of the Milwaukee Bucks to FIBA, and they said, that sounds perfect.
So the Bucks as a team were great, but not too great. And Milwaukee, well, it worked as a host city because it was fun, but not too fun. Here's the NBA's former PR chief, Brian McIntyre.
Yeah, I think we also, one other reason why I think we went to Milwaukee was we weren't 100% sure that an event like that would make as big a noise in, say, New York or L.A. as it would in a smaller market where it would just take over the whole show.
And Russ Granick, he agreed with that assessment.
And that's another reason we picked the Milwaukee, because we kind of figured it wouldn't get lost in the shuffle of New York or L.A. or something like that.
Okay, you guys are making it sound like there's nothing to do in Milwaukee. Silly NBA, nothing to do? That same weekend, there was plenty to do. There was a conference called Woman to Woman. There was a train show. That time of year, I mean, the walleyes are biting like Michigan. You know, they're lucky people even showed up, is what I'm trying to say. Because people showing up, that was the name of the game. Terry Lyons, who was the NBA's assistant PR director at the time, explains that for the league, the important thing was having keisters in those seats.
With the Milwaukee Bucks, we found a very willing participant in a building that we knew we could sell out because there were only 11,000 seats in the Mecca back then. And we wanted to be sure, you know, in preseason time in October that we could sell out.
So the real reason the tournament came to Milwaukee, why the NBA picked the Bucks to represent not just the league, but the red, white, and blue in their marquee matchup against the best national team in the world, our Cold War archenemy, the Soviet Union, was because Bucks fans, well, what can I say? We're the best.
It's a place that had a very rabid following.
That's former NBA PR chief Brian McIntyre.
The basketball fans in Milwaukee were very, very loyal. And they loved the team. They backed them. So we figured that's a good place to sell tickets, too, that they follow their team.
And according to longtime Bucks PR director Bill King, the Bucks were pumped to be the NBA's chosen team in the tournament.
I don't think it's the type of thing that you would turn down. There was no arm twisting there. It made a lot of sense to put the game in Milwaukee, and it worked well all the way around.
With the Bucks matchup against the Soviets set as the headliner, the tournament's third team was basically an afterthought for the NBA.
We knew if there was one thing the fans would want to see, it was to see one of our teams playing the Soviet Union.
Former NBA executive Russ Granick.
After that, whoever the third team was, I don't recall us having much input. We would have gone with whoever it was that Dr. Stankovic felt was good for FIBA.
For Boris, the choice was obvious. Because in Europe, there was a club team going on a generational run. One of the greatest EuroLeague teams of all time, Tracer Milan.
They just won the European Championship. They just won the Intercontinental Cup. They just won the Italian Championship. They won everything in a grand slam. And they're the best team in Europe, you know, and they're loaded.
That's Dan Peterson, the former head coach of Tracer Milan. Inducted into the FIBA Hall of Fame in 2024, he built Tracer into a dynasty. If anybody knew about the greatness of the reigning EuroLeague champions, it would be him. In the summer of 1987, after Tracer became the first club to win the European Grand Slam in over a decade, he retired on top. That was just months before the team would play in the FIBA NBA tournament. So Peterson was well aware of the star power on the third wheel of Boris Stankovic's upcoming basketball showcase.
Meneghin's in the Hall of Fame today. You know Mike D'Antoni, two-time NBA Coach of the Year. He's a point guard. He could have played in the NBA at that time. Bob McAdoo, Hall of Fame. You know, so Roberto Premier, two Olympics. But they were loaded, absolutely.
And with that, the tournament was set. The best national team in the world, the Soviet Union, would be joined by the European Grand Slam-winning club team Tracer Milan in a first-of-its-kind tournament hosted in Milwaukee by the Bucks. And soon, McDonald's came on board as the sponsor, and the three-team round-robin tournament had its name, the McDonald's Basketball Open. Boris finally had his shot, and he called Italian journalist Dario Colombo with the news.
This is the first time I say this. I've been the first people to be informed of McDonald's Open by Boris Stankovic. He called me and say, Dario, at least we have an international tournament with the NBA team. And so, yes, Boris, you did a great job. Congratulations. And the very first people to be happy for this is myself.
5 years after Boris revealed his dream to Dario in 1982, his dream to unite the worlds of basketball, Boris finally had his chance to show the world what it would look like to have the NBA take the same floor as the best international talent. For Dario, the McDonald's Open would become a crowning achievement in Boris's storied career.
This is probably the top one milestone in his career, because you cannot even think about this 10 years before that, just because the two worlds were not considering themselves. This is the main milestone in Boris Stankovic's career, absolutely, the main one.
In June of 1987, during the NBA Finals, David Stern and Boris Stankovic officially announced the McDonald's Open, which would tip off a few months later in October. A world away, players on the Soviet national team and Tracer Milan reacted to the news that they would be part of this historic competition.
He had a meeting and he told us, yeah, we're going to have an invitation to play McDonald's Open. It's going to be first ever national team will play against pro basketball team.
Soviet star forward Alexander Volkov told us about when his team got the news from head coach Alexander Gomelsky.
We was so excited. We said, oh my God, it's really happened. And we had not many of us really believe it's happened.
And that disbelief is the exact same feeling Volkov's superstar teammate, Sarunas Marcelonis, described when he spoke to us.
Sometimes you have a feeling that it's true, but you don't believe it, you know? So it's like it's a reality, but you really don't believe it. It happened with me. That was so kind of, you know, you're dreaming, you know.
For Mascherlonis, the opportunity to compete against an NBA team just didn't feel real.
Nobody introduced us, let's say, before season. Oh, here's a plan for a Soviet national team. We were going to go there, here, there. So we were like always in the dark. So that was also out of blue sky, you know, so this trip to play against, you know, Milwaukee Bucks, you know, so we were like, we're still in the shock.
In Milan, legendary center Dino Meneghin was the Tom Brady of the EuroLeague, winning a record 7 EuroLeague titles. He may be the greatest Italian basketball player of all time, and his team was winning everything there was to win in Europe. Meneghin was actually one of the first European players ever drafted in the NBA. But like so many foreign-born stars of his era, he chose to remain in Europe to preserve his amateur status and play for the Italian national team. The tournament was his chance to finally live out his NBA dreams. But when we caught up with Meneghin, he told us he even had some imposter syndrome when he heard Tracer Milan was chosen to compete in the tournament.
I didn't expect that we could play with an NBA team, such a big tournament in the States.
For Meneghin, the invitation was the ultimate affirmation of Tracer's accomplishments in Europe.
It was a great satisfaction. Finally, the NBA organization thinks that even outside of the United States, there's great teams and great basketball and good basketball. It was a kind of, you are here, you're very important, so you have the chance to play this great tournament. So let's see how big you are. So it was a great challenge. It was a great challenge.
While Tracer Milan and the Soviet national team were celebrating their invitations to the McDonald's Open, Bucks head coach Del Harris, he was getting to work.
I became head coach at that point. Now, this is the summer of 87, and the first thing I find out is that we've agreed to play in this thing called the McDonald's Open.
Del had just been promoted to the top job after being a longtime assistant to former Bucks head coach Don Nelson. If replacing Nelly wasn't hard enough, dealing with the McDonald's Open in the middle of his first training camp, not ideal.
Whatever it was, 3 or 4 days of training camp, and then the games. So that was the scary part.
It was scary for Dell because NBA Commissioner David Stern made his expectations for the tournament clear. Speaking to the press, Stern said, quote, "This is not a grudge match. We would like nice, friendly games. That we win," unquote. Emphasis on the winning. And he meant it.
Very stern-like. Yes, very stern-like.
That's Rick Welts' reaction to the Stern quote all these years later. At the time, Rick was the NBA VP of Communications, and he knew Stern wasn't bluffing. He spoke to us about the pressure on Del Harris and the Bucks to perform.
Oh, tremendous. Unspoken, but tremendous, because this whole idea of, you know, the NBA finally showing up on the international basketball scene with the best basketball in the world proclaimed was at risk.
For the Bucks, this would be uncharted territory. A total contradiction. A meaningless game that actually meant the world.
There's like a disproportionate amount of pressure in a game that didn't count in the standings for anything for the NBA team. It just was only about reputation and the prestige of the NBA as the preeminent brand of basketball in the world.
Then NBA EVP Russ Granick co-signed that position.
Oh, I think it was important that the Bucks win. We believed that the NBA was still far and away ahead of the rest of the world in the sport. And so even just picking up an individual team that wasn't the NBA champion, they could still beat the best that was out there in the rest of the world.
Del Harris would become the first head coach to lead a team of NBA talent in an international competition. That responsibility was a unique burden.
Yes, there was some pressure on the NBA team to win the tournament. You know, that if we went and dropped the games, that would have not looked great for the league.
This is Terry Lyons, the NBA's associate PR director at the time.
I think in those international games, there was a lot of pressure that fell on the head coach to win.
And here's Terry's boss at the NBA, Brian McIntyre, on why Dell was just the first in a long line of NBA coaches who would bear the pressure of succeeding in international competition.
The single most nervous time I've ever seen any of our coaches. is in that in the international competition. None of them wanted to be the first one to lose. That's a heck of a burden for someone to carry. And so, I'm sure that Del Harris felt a lot of pressure to come through. Plus, he didn't have all his players for that. Some of his top players weren't in camp because they hadn't signed contracts. So that made it what it would already be a little bit of a tense situation sweaty palm situation, a little bit sweatier.
That's right. Just days before that opening match, Dell got news that his best player, future Hall of Famer Sidney Moncrief, would have to miss the tournament after undergoing an unexpected knee surgery. And Moncrief, who was just coming off a season where he was named first-team All-Defense and second-team All-NBA, wouldn't be the only important player who would have to miss the game.
There was a fair amount of trepidation, however, because the pride of the NBA and the USA was on the line.
Here is Bill King, who was the Bucks PR director at the time.
As I'm sure you found out, we were very thin in the guard corps, and it was preseason for us. So we did not have our multi-time defensive player of the year, Sidney Moncrief. We did not have the sixth man of the year in Ricky Pierce. We didn't have Craig Hodges or John Lucas, who had not yet signed a contract for that season. So there's four players who definitely would have been rotation players, if not starters, on that team. And so that's where the trepidation came in, because we pretty much have to guarantee a win to Commissioner Stir.
McDonald's was putting up $100,000 in prize money for the tournament. But Del Harris understood there was a lot more on the line for the Bucks than being able to buy a lifetime supply of Big Macs.
We played a lot of preseason games, and they were all just, we'll play some guys, we'll do this, do that. This was different. In retrospect, it's the only preseason game I felt like we had to win. We were expected to carry the torch for the league, so the heat was on us. We just couldn't afford to lose.
More on Behind the Bucks, presented by Gallagher, coming up after this.
Behind the Bucks is presented by Gallagher. Trust is the foundation of any successful partnership, especially when it comes to managing risk and planning your future. That's why businesses turn to Gallagher. With over 95 years of experience, Gallagher has the expertise to help businesses navigate complex challenges and seize new opportunities. As a proud partner of the Milwaukee Bucks, Gallagher is dedicated to building confidence together. To learn more, visit AJG.com. Gallagher, your trusted insurance broker and H&R Benefits consultant.
In his first season as Bucks head coach, in the middle of training camp, Dell had to uphold the reputation of not just the league, but the country. And according to the Boston Globe's Bob Ryan, Dell felt it was a tough position to be in.
He hated it.
I found out in my research that Del Harris wished this whole thing weren't happening, or at least if somebody else was involved. I think he was petrified if we ever lost. He said, "Why me?" I mean, I believe that was his attitude, that he had, how did I get myself in this mess? That's how way Del Harris felt.
Which explains why a few days before the tournament, Del did something he had never done before or after. He closed his practices to the media, all to maintain a competitive advantage.
We had always left it open before, and I did after. But this was different. I didn't want the press to be evaluating my coaching. Plus, they didn't know what I was going to use. They could have scouted before, but they didn't know what we were going to use. So they had literally no scouting report on us. And so I wasn't going to give it up.
Meanwhile, the press had full access to the Tracer Milan team, even if they didn't find them very interesting. As Sports Illustrated's Jack McCallum explains it, Tracer Milan was basically the jilted lover in the distracted boyfriend meme.
We knew it was a big story for us, and we were curious about the Soviets. We didn't have a lot of curiosity about Tracer Milan, but the Soviets were a big thing.
But Tracer, which was tipping off the tournament with a game against the Bucks, wasn't just the second fiddle. They were the first fiddle. They were like the Jimi Hendrix of fiddlers. Let's start with Dino Menegin, a.k.a. EuroLeague Tom Brady. How great was he? Just ask him.
I was have been the best player in the world. I'm joking. I was have been a defensive player. I didn't care, honestly, didn't care about how much point I could score. For me, it was much better to make a great assist. And especially in defense, when I had to play versus somebody, and generally, I mean, the score, the average of the score was 20, 25. When I entered on the court, I was thinking, okay, this guy, he cannot score more than 10, 12 points versus me. And this was my job. For me, the most important thing that the team could win the game.
And he was willing to do what he had to in the trenches to get his team the win. This is Tim Shea, an American who was a longtime player and coach in Europe.
Dino was a brute. You know, he would just as easily take your head off as he would shake your hand. I mean, that's the way it was. You know, Dino didn't screw around. You know, he didn't take any prisoners.
And in the front court, alongside Dino, was the team's superstar, a top 75 NBA player of all time, a former NBA MVP, three-time scoring champ, and two-time NBA champion, a certified legend, Bob McAdoo. And he wasn't just coming to Wisconsin to watch the leaves change color and maybe go hit a hammock up there in Sister Bay. He had something to prove.
I was excited because I wanted to show people, hey, you made a mistake letting me go to Europe, you know? And I think that's what I showed people.
And if you're having trouble remembering the type of player Bob was, he knows of a player who could help give you an idea.
Kevin Durant.
Durant for three for the win. He's got it! He's got it! Durant. The fake. The second. Oh! Ankle breaker!
He's the one that reminds me of me because he shoots it from everywhere on the court. He can handle the ball and get where he wants to get on the court. I would get it off the rim on a rebound and dribble coast to coast and make a play. Guys who know NBA history will tell you that I was probably the first stretch five, stretch four in the league in the 70s.
You are watching the most valuable player in the NBA, Buffalo's Bob McAdoo. McAdoo, 8 rebounds this quarter. McAdoo. That's 33 points for the MVP.
For over a decade, Tracer Milan had been dominating the Italian league, but falling short of the EuroLeague title. So when Bob McAdoo signed in 1986, Dino Menegin got the feeling that things were going to change.
At the beginning, I thought, okay, this is another great player that he comes here just to have some vacation and play like this, like that. He doesn't care. He stay here 1 year, then he get back home. But after the first practices, I realized that it was a completely different story. Bob was that time, I think he's one of the best player we had in Italy all time. He forced us to grow up. If you want to stay to his level, you must practice harder.
For a team like Tracer that won a lot of games but couldn't win the EuroLeague, Bob McAdoo gave the team a spirit that helped it ascend to a championship level.
Bob showed us how to stay at the great level for many years. Every game we won, every championship we won, we are hungry about this. We want another situation like this, another feeling like this.
Because as Dino quickly found out, Bob was a real one.
We had a young player. He didn't care so much, you know. Went on the court just playing like this, like that. Just, okay, what time is it's time to go home or whatever. And so Bob, the first days, he was looking at him and didn't say anything. One time, I mean, this guy came on the locker room and he said, hey, guys, I bought a new Pajero.
A Pajero was a popular SUV at the time.
And Bob said nothing. We went up on the court to practice. He didn't practice.
And that's when Bob had to set an example.
Get back to the locker room. Bob, take this guy here, hang him right here, and put him on the wall. And you say that you must change your attitude. You have a bad attitude because I'm trying to break my balls just because you could buy a new Pajero. You, excuse me for the word, but so you understand how was the mentality of the great Bob. Everybody, all the other, they were looking and say, okay, we must put higher and higher the level. I don't want to be picked by Bob and pushed on the wall.
For former NBA players like McAdoo, Milan had a clear appeal. As Italian journalist Dario Colombo explains, the team became a powerhouse, partly because the vibes were simply immaculate.
Milan is fashion. Milan is good food. Milan is many, many things with a lot of appeal for good players. That's the reason why Milan in the years became the top team in Europe.
And for a certain point guard from West Virginia, after a cup of coffee in the NBA, he settled into a life of cappuccinos in Milan.
I played with that team for 13 years. We would always meet at this restaurant after every game, probably twice a week, with our families, with the coaches, with the general manager, with the owner. And we all sat down and have an Italian dinner that would start around 8. And we'd leave the restaurant around 2 o'clock in the morning.
That's Mike D'Antoni. Along with Dino Meneghin and Coach Dan Peterson, he helped build Tracer Milan into a perennial contender in Europe.
The restaurant was co-owned by Santo Versace, which is a member of the Versace family. So in the front row, you have models, actresses. I remember Fellini was there, the director, famous director, was there one day. And so all these people, it was just a very heady worldly experience every time we went there, but we grew up as a team. From all of us were not married, who we had were engaged, who we were married, we had kids, and we went through the whole cycle of life that I don't think you can duplicate the commonality or the bond that we had as players.
The Italian league limited its teams to a maximum of 2 American players. But because he was a dual citizen of the U.S. and Italy, D'Antoni didn't count against that quota. Tracer was basically able to add an extra American to their roster, which is how they added Ricky Brown to the team.
Mike D'Antoni was like a floor general out there. He was like the second coach of the team.
That was Ricky Brown, who played 5 years in the NBA before becoming one of the best centers in Europe. Having an Italian-American point guard made acclimating to a new life in Italy off the court a whole lot easier. And as Bob McAdoo explains, it also helped with life on the court.
Mike D'Antoni, who was Italian-American, which was good for me because he was an American point guard, which made it easier for me because I know a lot of American players would go over there and they would have Italian point guards. And they didn't have the expertise that Mike had as far as getting you the ball in the right place. I mean, Mike was perfect for me and Ricky Brown and the guys that I played with in Milan.
Sure, D'Antoni would go on to become a very successful head coach in the NBA. So, of course, he was a floor general. And let me guess, I bet he was a scrappy gamer with a high motor. But does D'Antoni have a comp in the modern NBA that can give us an idea of how he played the game?
Yeah, it's a loaded question. Probably a guy that just got cut last week from it. Because that happened to me a few times. So that would probably be the most adequate description. Again, let's put it in context. They're all much better. I would say more of the line of like Drew Holiday.
Knocked away and stolen by Holiday.
4 to play.
Not compared to his talent, but to where he is good offensively, but he has to be super good on defense and a tough competitor.
That's not just D'Antoni being modest. According to his teammate, Dino Meneghin, he drove opponents crazy on the court.
They call him in Italy Arsenio Lupin. Arsenio Lupin is a great thief for France, you know, the legend over there, because he was great with the quick hands, you know. When I play with them, I realized that all these opponents, when they came up dribbling due to offense, they were thinking, oh, must be careful because Mike can get me the ball. So they didn't play so tranquil, so quiet. They were afraid of the steals.
Some fans in the U.S. may have forgotten about D'Antoni by the time he returned stateside in the McDonald's Open. But in Italy, he was still a legend. Longtime NBA photographer Andrew Bernstein saw it firsthand when he traveled to Italy with D'Antoni for a Phoenix Suns training camp one year.
In Treviso, which is Mike is literally a hero, there's a statue of Mike D'Antoni in Treviso, Italy, where he played. It's crazy. He's literally a god over there.
But by the time D'Antoni and Tracer Milan got to Milwaukee for the tournament, Italy's point guard was feeling like a mere mortal.
We have any chance of winning? No. We've got some good players, but we're not deep.
This is from an interview he gave to Fox 6 after Tracer's first practice in Milwaukee.
We're going to play 48 minutes. We've got about six good players. You know, we realize the Bucks are one of the best teams in the world. The NBA as a league is the best place to play basketball in the world.
Looking back, competing in the McDonald's Open was about more than wins and losses to D'Antoni. It was about showing his teammates what the NBA was all about.
Well, I think I was more excited about the Italians I were playing with to be able to show them in the United States, show them what the NBA was about, and to go into, you know, a competition against the NBA with my best buds who, you know, were by my side the last 10 years. I was just excited for them to experience what I've experienced as a player in the NBA.
The McDonald's Open was set to tip off with Tracer Milan taking on the Bucks.
But because there weren't a ton of NBA games on TV in Italy at the time, Dino Meneghin had to get the scouting report from his teammates with NBA experience.
I tried to ask Mike and Bob and Hughes regarding the Milwaukee, the city and whatever. We didn't know any of them, just Jack Sigmar.
Buck center Jack Sigmar was a seven-time All-Star and NBA champion from his time on the Seattle Supersonics, and he was a star in Europe. So the scouting report on Sigmar, who is Dino's matchup in the upcoming game, it didn't come from Mike D'Antoni and Bob McAdoo. It came from Dino's teenage son, Giuseppe.
Giuseppe was 13 years old, and he was a great fan of Sigmar. And every time I was with him, he always talking about Sigmar. It's enough talking about Bob McAdoo, but not Sigmar.
But even for a legend like Dino Meneghin, the EuroLeague Tom Brady, he was starstruck the first time he saw Sigmar in warm-ups before the game.
So when I saw him on the court, I should like to go to them and say, hey, you know that my son is your great friend? But he didn't have the heart to go there because I don't want to disturb him. But the next time, if I had the chance to meet him somewhere, somehow I got to tell him all these words.
Just as Meneghin was in awe when he saw Sigmar, the NBA wanted to make a strong first impression on FIBA's Secretary General, Boris Stankovic.
I'll tell you, like, really my best memory.
This is Rick Welts, who at the time was the NBA's VP of Communications. He helped put together a very elaborate welcome for the NBA's guest of honor.
I'm sure you've heard from everyone that Boris Stankovic was maybe one of the kindest, gentlest human beings in the world. Nothing but a true gentleman. We were trying to design something where he felt treated like a head of state, which in retrospect is really very funny because he's not that person.
When Boris landed in Milwaukee for the McDonald's Open, Rick wanted to greet him at the airport in style. No, Rick wasn't taking him to the taxi stand. He had another ride in mind.
I greeted him when he got off the plane. You know, Mr. Secretary General, we have, you know, a nice little surprise to start the visit. We're not going to drive downtown. We're going to take you by helicopter to go to downtown Milwaukee. And I'm sure thought that was a super crazy notion at the time.
Yep. Rick called in the helicopter to take Boris a few miles down the road. But that was only the beginning. The helicopter would land in a nearby park on Lake Michigan, where it would be surrounded by over a dozen police cars.
And as the helicopter touches down, I'll never forget this, like this semicircle of police cars all turn on their lights and approach in a semicircle toward the helicopter, and we whisk Stankovic into a limousine and rode the three-block motorcade to the Hyatt Hotel in downtown Milwaukee. I'm sure at that point, he thought we had totally lost our minds.
But as out of his element as Boris was when Rick greeted him with the helicopter and motorcade, on Friday, October 23rd, in a packed Milwaukee arena, Boris Stankovic was right at home on the hardwood. Standing at half court next to NBA Commissioner David Stern, Boris welcomed the world to the McDonald's Open. He had finally brought his vision for the future of basketball to life.
Basketball, unity through the world. Thanks to the collaboration and cooperation of the NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks, ABA USA, the Soviet Basketball Federation, and the Tracer Club from Milan, Italy, we have succeeded in launching this event. Once again, thank you to everyone for their tremendous help. And in conclusion, I wish all participants the best possible success. Thank you.
Tracer Milan's former coach Dan Peterson was at the game in Milwaukee, broadcasting the match to fans in Italy.
Amici sportivi, saluti e benvenuti alla settima puntata di Domenica, Italia Uno Sport.
From a pure historical point of view, it was a historical event.
Alla Mecca, Milwaukee Arena, nello spogliatoio dei Milwaukee Bucks.
You couldn't get in the arena, it was sold out every night. It was a major event, and you felt the atmosphere, and I tried to tell that to the fans. You know, hey, come on, they're into this here. They're not treating this like just some, you know, preseason game. You know, they want an inside look at their team. They want to see what international basketball looks like. There was great atmosphere, even up and down press row.
Journalist Mary Schmidt-Boyer was one of three reporters covering the game for the local Milwaukee Journal. And she could tell, like Dan was saying, this was far from a normal preseason game.
The coverage was more like you would get in an Olympics. And that was kind of exciting, frankly, for reporters. You know, the only other setting for that kind of thing is usually the Olympics.
Mary's colleague at the Journal, Bob Berghaus, could feel the excitement throughout the city for the tournament.
It was a big deal. I knew it was a big deal. You know, I was there as like the secondary guy for our paper, but my stuff was getting on the front page and people were reading it. You know, I took a lot of pride in it, and Mary did too.
Now, to commemorate the McDonald's Basketball Open, the captains of the three teams will exchange gifts. Mike D'Antoni of Tracer Milan. Vladis Komitsis of the Soviet national team. And Paul Cressy of the Milwaukee Bucks.
As the three team captains came to midcourt to exchange gifts, then NBA VP of Communications Rick Welts described what it was like in the stands as the crowd awaited the game to tip off.
I think there was a real electricity around it because it was just brand new. And I don't think anyone really knew what to expect. No one really knew what the competitive landscape would look like. I think there was real electricity in the building about what was about to unfold because it had never happened before.
That electricity in the arena made Bucks star Terry Cummins feel like something special was about to take place.
At forward, 6'9", number 34, Terry Cummins.
I think that was what I remember. You know, I remember the hype because it was a big thing. You know, Milwaukee is a small town, small market. It was just a really big thing for us to represent the NBA and the country, too.
On the court, Tino Meneghin was soaking up the moment.
At center, 6'9", number 11, Tino Meneghin.
The first time I came on that beautiful stadium, it was like a great respect. Look where you are now. Try to make the best you can.
And he was trying to pick up a thing or two from the Bucks' layup lines.
During the warming up, I was looking what they are acting, where they're moving, what they are doing. You have always to learn from somebody else.
Bob McAdoo, who had enjoyed many battles against the Bucks in the NBA, understood that the world was about to witness something they had never seen before.
At forward, 6'10", number 15, Bob McAdoo.
It was different because they weren't playing NBA competition. They were playing the EuroLeague champion. There was a lot of buzz, a lot of excitement.
McAdoo knew he was playing for respect, but the Bucks were playing for a lot more than that.
I'm sure it was a lot of pressure. They knew you know, being an NBA team, they had to win that thing.
Jim Paschke, who had recently become a broadcaster for the Bucks, watched from the crowd and prayed the Bucks wouldn't blow it against Europe's best.
I just remember watching and hoping that the Bucks were able to do what the league hoped they could do. You know, I just watched and said, come on, you got to win. We didn't know a lot about the foreign players. And, you know, you mentioned Menyan, and, you know, it was fun seeing those guys and seeing what level they were at.
And on paper, Tracer had one clear advantage on the Bucks: conditioning. Because Tracer was well into their regular season while the Bucks were still ramping up at training camp.
Bucks were just starting their preseason probably.
Tracer Milan point guard Mike D'Antoni.
So we were hoping to catch them a little bit unprepared.
And former Tracer Milan coach Dan Peterson thought their championship pedigree could give his old team the edge in the opening matchup against the Bucks.
I thought Milan had a chance. They'd had the Intercontinental Cup. They had the nucleus of a championship team back. I thought Milan had a chance just because they were deeper into their season.
Calling the game for fans in Italy, Peterson couldn't help but root for Tracer to pull off a historic upset.
I was kind of pulling for Milan to upset the Bucks, okay? I wanted to see my former team do that, you know, absolutely.
But when the game finally tipped off, Milan quickly realized it had never played a team like the Bucks.
Oh, yeah. I remember a lot of it. I remember, you know, Paul Presley was unbelievable with his long arms.
Mike D'Antoni.
They put a press on us, and man, he was eating me up for a while.
Paul Pressey, the Bucks' point forward, was coming off three consecutive all-defensive teams. He was a nightmare for Milan's guards. Speaking to Pressey, it was clear he thought the Bucks needed to make a statement.
It was strange for me because I just looked at the team, and I'm like, these guys trying to play our game? You know, we're supposed to blow these guys out the gym.
And that's what the Bucks did.
Slam dunk by McCann on the follow.
By the second quarter, the Bucks had a 30-point lead on the EuroLeague champs, 56-26. And at halftime, it wasn't much closer.
And that's the end of the first half from the Milwaukee Arena. The Bucks have led from start to finish of the first half. It's 64-44 at the half.
The Bucks at the time was one of the best defensive teams in the league, particularly on the guard side.
Tracer Milan center, Ricky Brown.
Our guards had a hard time getting their shots off. That's why it was easier for me and McAdoo to get our shots, because, you know, we could hold our own inside against their big guys.
A former NBA champion and MVP, Bob McAdoo understood the talent disparity between the two teams.
I know it's going to be a tough game because they had a lot of size, and our European players wasn't used to that type of athleticism from every position.
But he knew if Tracer was going to have a chance, he would have to light it up.
You know, when you're playing in a game like that, you want to make sure you got your game on par. And I knew I was going to be matched up against the top power forward in the league and Terry Cummins.
The top power forward in the league? McAdoo is talking about Buck star Terry Cummins, an all-star and all-NBA caliber player who had led the team to the Eastern Conference Finals. For his part, Terry cherished the opportunity to compete with a legend like McAdoo.
Pressey on the drive, leaves it for Cummins.
Yeah, I'm a student of the game. I mean, Bob McAdoo was like a history lesson. I mean, he was a great scorer, great player.
But after being down by 20 points in the third quarter, McAdoo put the team on his back like a limping Greg Jennings. He scored 14 points in the fourth quarter to get Milan back in the game.
Ricky Brown takes it down. McAdoo with the jackknife jumper. Bob McAdoo with 23 points.
McAdoo. McAdoo. Appena prima di 24 secondi.
Anybody that was guarding me, I wanted to make it tough for them. And I did. I made it tough for them and impossible to guard me, you know. That's what I remember. I think I kind of showed them the league. I wasn't over the hill at 36 because I gave him some numbers.
Mike McAdoo! Bob McAdoo!
Mike sta facendo veramente
dei numeri qui a Milwaukee.
Buck star big man Jack Sigma was not surprised to see a vintage performance by McAdoo.
It wasn't a surprise. He's a scorer. His career speaks for himself. He led the league in scoring a couple times, so we knew he was going to be a handful.
To get back into the game, Milan used the hybrid FIBA NBA rules of the tournament to their advantage. At the time, for example, zone defenses were illegal in the NBA, but at the McDonald's Open, teams were allowed to use them. So the Bucks were a little tripped up when Milan went to the zone, and Tracer was able to chip away at the lead.
Fly to the Struder, intercepted by Bozecchi. Mike the trail, scadere del quarto, va!
Tracer Milan point guard, Mike D'Antoni.
One time we started clicking pretty good. I'm thinking, you know, we get lucky or get a couple shots, but they miss something or screw up, we have a chance.
The tournament also featured a three-point line that split the difference between the NBA's longer arc and FIBA's shorter one. At first, while adjusting to the new three-point line, D'Antoni was colder than a Lambo tailgate. But late in the game, he started to cook from deep.
D'Antoni cans a three-pointer.
Rick Welts, who helped put on the event for the NBA, took notice.
None of us had ever heard of Mike D'Antoni. And here he was like orchestrating this, you know, that comeback. It was like, oh, okay, that guy's pretty good.
And as Tracer cut the lead in the fourth quarter, Welts started to get nervous.
Three-pointer by D'Antoni.
I remember, you know, a constant angst about the outcome of the game.
And D'Antoni was leading the comeback, locking in on both ends of the court.
Second three-pointer of the game for Mike D'Antoni, and the Bucks' lead is cut to 16 points.
I did have a triple-double, but actually I had a quadruple-double because I had also 10 turnovers.
D'Antoni put up a monster stat line with 16 points, 10 rebounds, 11 steals, and yeah, 10 turnovers.
So I had a quadruple-double on that game.
D'Antoni with another steal.
With 4:29 left in the fourth, McAdoo hit a jumper to make it a 9-point game, 100-109. And the crowd was stunned.
Milwaukee Bucks, 4:37 remaining, so time becoming a factor now.
Here's former Tracer Milan coach Dan Peterson, who called the game for an Italian broadcast.
I was telling the fans, hey, we're back in the game, okay? It looked bad there for a while, but we're back.
As Tracer Milan stormed back, McAdoo would finish with 36 points and 12 rebounds, while Ricky Brown dropped 26 points and snagged 19 rebounds. The NBA alums on Milan were showing they could stand out in their return to the NBA stage. Going down to the wire, Hall of Famer Rick Barry, who is calling the game for TBS, recognized that this type of showcase is exactly what Boris Stankovic had set out to achieve.
Boris Stankovic has got to be loving this. He wants to open competition up. He said that they'd like to see the pros playing. And with the performance out here tonight, with the Tracer Milan team making a game of it, trailing only by 9, he has done nothing. They have done nothing but add fuel to the fire of Boris Stankovic.
Now within reach, and the chance to steal victory in the final possessions, Dino Meneghin knew it was a game he would never forget.
I remember the great game of Ricky Brown, Bob McAdoo, Mike D'Antoni, even Premier, they were so good. I put in my mind the pictures, all these pictures, that I never forget for all my life.
I'm Charlie Behrens, and here's what to expect on the next Behind the Bucks, presented by Gallagher.
But people were really, really, really animated. And I think it raised the specter that the Bucks could be challenged in the final game. That if they end up playing the Soviets, that, you know, certainly going to be a possibility that they were going to get beat.
They could embarrass us. And I do know coming out of it, there was a lot of people said, hey, if the Bucks play like this, they're going to have their hands full with the Soviet Union. We felt we were carrying the banner for the NBA and USA basketball.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.